Side 2 of session number 36, recorded on April 9th, 2007. And we're just going to finish up what I was saying at the end of Side 1. I was thinking about Croker describes everything disappearing in a kind of silence, but he says the content of the silence is a kind of Brownian motion of quark particles. Postmodern self and all its media and signs of media are like quark particles. In fibrillation might have been the word. Quark Brownian motion.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just looking up in the previous section on panic waiting. Panic waiting, he says, describing the people in the bathtub painting, says here everything is a matter of canceled identities, silence, and waiting with no expectation of relief. And in brackets after canceled identities, he says the background figure has no head, the woman's gaze is averted. After silence, it says in brackets, broken only by the ocular sounds of surveillance. Remember, I was talking about surveillance? That means visual.
Mm-hmm.
Eye sounds, of the sounds of surveillance.
Mm-hmm.
So, maybe that's why people think we're living in a visual society. It's the ocular sounds of surveillance in the Brownian motion, of the Brownian motion.
Yeah, that's kind of a synesthesia idea, because ocular doesn't imply sound unless you...
That's right. Yeah, it's synesthesia.
Yeah.
Okay, so what do you want to do with the panic question?
Well, just a couple fine points here. We go back towards the beginning of panic questions. Postmodern scene works also to show that sadomasochism is now a little sign slide between the ecstasy of catastrophe and the terror of the simulacrum as a disappearing sign of the times. Is he saying the simulacrum is a disappearing sign of the times?
Yeah, that's where he's post-Baudrillard. The simulacrum was 70s and 80s. But here's Croker moving into the later 80s, and he's operating from not a postmodern statement, but a bimodern. And we're going to see that near the end of the Croker section. His definition of what he's doing is bimodernism, not postmodern. And the postmodern deals with the simulacrum, but he saw that even it was disappearing, or maybe in my terms, shrinking in that sense. The Android meme disappears itself, makes itself more compressed, more seductive. So as a disappearing, the terror of the simulacrum as a sign of the times, he sees it disappearing. So he's in the interval. He's almost picking up on the interactiveness of voluntary ESP that digital media are going to bring in with the personal computer, that kills the hologram that P.K. Dick was talking about.
Oh, okay. So we were...
of the cloned ESP phase.
Yeah. So even when all we were left with to cling to as a sense of identity was the simulacrum, when that started to disappear, then we started to panic, because even a AirSat's identity was disappearing. We had nothing to cling to.
Yeah, so that's why we became suicidal or passive nihilists. And so all of that is corrected or flipped out of with the voluntary ESP of the 90s. And so it's very interesting to read the later Croker in books like Spasm and especially Data Trash, and then later Digital Delirium, read what he has to say about the recovering resurrection from the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
He's very inventory-like. He'll list off characteristics, like at the bottom of this first paragraph, he says, describing the self, it's neither fully mediated, that means it's starting to disconnect from the simulacrum, right?
Mm-hmm.
Neither fully mediated, at least in the old analog broadcast media sense of the cloned ESP phase, because the new media, which is interactive, is a mediated situation. Anyways, neither fully mediated nor entirely localized. So it's neither fully globalized nor entirely localized. The self is an empty sign.
Hmm.
And then it has various aspects of it. It's colonized from within by technologies for the body immune. That would be pharmaceutical drugs put into people. Or antibiotics for people having AIDS. Immune deficiency problems. Seduced from without by all of the fashion tattoos. I talk about the TV body is is expressed by young people when they make tattoos on themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They're expressing the fact they got something else attached to them. And then the little studs in the tongue, the genitals, or the ears is the chip body. But the tattooing he has here, seduced from without by all the fashion tattoos, that would be the TV landscape, and energized by a novel psychological condition. And what is that condition? Being simultaneously predator and parasite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, in light of this sadomasochism, remember he talks about abuse value in the economy.
Right.
It's sort of like sadomasochism.
What's where he's referring to colonized from within by technologies for the body immune? What does
that's
he mean by
medical technologies?
The body immune.
See, the immune system became a big topic in big medicine in the 80s.
Mm.
So they're worried about the chemical body being immune.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a time of AIDS, time of herpes, and other ravagings of the body. And so they're trying to make it immune.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the focusing on the chemical body and not looking at the simulacrum and its disappearance leading to the chip body as energizing and making the old chemical body a ghetto.
Uh-huh.
That needs to be immunized.
Yeah.
Now, this whole pessimism.
The schizoid state of postmodern selves who are simultaneously predators and parasites. What's the predator and parasite dichotomy there?
Well, predators are corporate raiders.
No.
Or yourself, or anybody in the information game, gathering a mosaic of influences and data and then spewing it out.
Mm.
At the same time, though, you're a parasite because you, you need to come up with some media product that'll be content for the media scape.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever you produce will be just your means to survive and would not have any of the noble values of cultural products in the Gutenberg phase, so-called anti-environmental function. There's no way to be anti-environment in the Android meme phase or the simulacrum phase that he's describing. So at best you survive as a parasite and predator.
Mm-hmm.
You're both conditions, because actually you got more than one body. So you're a predator in information creativity, and you're also a parasite because you got to absorb all this other information that you're going to redesign and then predate with.
Well, I guess that relates to this idea of where he's discussing evokes the idea of sadomasochism. Because if you're the victim and the victimizer,
yeah,
you're the predator and the parasite,
right.
You're in a rather, sounds like an unhappy situation.
Yeah, for the traditional humanist values of purposeful life, or a purposeful chemical body.
Well, you're cannibalizing yourself.
Yeah. Well, that's McLuhan's point. The super audience, like the super enterprise, works for itself.
Mm-hmm.
And eats itself.
The super audience, like the super enterprise, how is he distinguishing the one from the other? Super audience versus super enterprise.
Who, McLuhan?
Yeah.
No, it's just the super audience. But he said, like the super enterprise. The super audience is the super enterprise.
Oh.
That's what we have today in hyper participatory mode of reality TV shows or American Idol kind of shows. The main point is they're doing fitting his wake. They're letting everybody on stage.
Right.
And that's how the Android meme, you know, keeps itself going, by knocking down the velvet ropes.
Right.
The old elitism of former cultural skills. Now, look, we're describing McLuhan, but in a hyper reference to the disservices, largely.
Mm.
Though Kroger doesn't totally agree that it's a disservice. I mean, he's into being pessimist.
Mm-hmm.
So we should read the next section where he sums up McLuhan's career, and you'll see how he distinguishes himself from McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
But before we do that, we can go into the pessimism streak. The hyper-pessimism today is the only realistic basis for a raging will to political action. What is political action in that situation?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, writing books, is that what Kroger thinks is political?
Well, he seems he refers to when a conversation that he has with you that you need to have a certain comportment towards the environment, a certain attitude or disposition. So I think he says you just you have to take on this particular sort of attitude or disposition.
Yeah, and you may be talking about all political action is, remember, postmodern self is cynical. So we had an earlier quote about that, I think. And so all political action is based on a cynical attitude that nothing you're going to do is really going to accomplish anything.
Well, in the 60s, you know, they went out on the streets and they had to call in the National Guard, and it turned into a big confrontation. Recently, I saw a TV ad protesting big tobacco, where they had, like, I don't know, about 1,000 people outside of corporate headquarters of Big Tobacco, and they all fall to the ground and play dead all at once. And then, you know, the subtext says, you know, 1,400 people die from tobacco every day. And so that was an act of just of cultural cynicism and cultural pessimism. It wasn't confronting like the kind of
had no point of view.
Yeah, it had
performance.
Yeah. It wasn't, you know, people weren't gathering in, like, at Kent State to rally and protest. They just were
creating an event, a media event. They were being parasites and predators.
Yeah.
Now the it's interesting. This started in Seattle maybe in '99 as protests started to get so-called creative and bring in a lot of entertainment or skits or humor in their protests.
Mm-hmm.
And so we could look at that. The street political actions are incorporating the global theater aspect of the 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm.
It's now an old environment, and they're bringing it back because they see the movie, the whole political action in the mediascape as a theatrical situation.
Yeah.
And whereas in the 60s, they were literate people with points of view colliding with other points of view.
Yeah.
There's more of a sense of a put-on.
Yeah.
So the satellite effect has, it was new in the 60s, but it's been absorbed as a practical strategy in the last 10 years.
Yeah. I remember, I think it was in the early 90s, Oliver Stone did a movie. I can't remember the name of it.
Natural Born Killers?
Yeah. And one of the techniques he employed, if it was that movie, I think it was that movie, was that he would have the actors doing some kind of an event that had some kind of irony and violence, and then he would turn up the soundtrack of the laugh track of the audience in the background.
Right.
Now, was
he became a TV show?
Yeah. Was the laugh track of the audience supposed to represent the super audience?
Yeah. Yeah, the fact that everything was on camera.
Yeah.
It's another way of showing the global theater.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then there was a film after that with Jim Carrey where he plays this guy who's always under surveillance in his life.
Yeah, the Truman Show.
Truman Show, yeah. So there was another attempt.
Now, the point is that those guys were bringing in awareness of the global theater aspect.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was obsolete by the... That's a simulacrum or P.K. Dick's hologram. That's obsolete, as Croker intimates in the middle 80s, by the 90s.
Mm.
Now it is no space with people making their own media vomit within and interacting with other media vomit.
Oh, so Big Brother's gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm.
The simulation of Big Brother.
Right.
Remember, McLuhan said Big Brother went inside, you know, in the radio, or at least in the 50s. Went inside.
Right.
So another thing is, so he's got cultural pessimism as the only sharpening of the will which permits us to break forever with all the liberal compromises.
Yeah, that phrase, sharpening of the will, harks back to his identification with Nietzsche.
Right, and the basis, the sentence before, the basis for a raging will, the political action.
Yeah.
But
Nietzsche felt that the will was the most essential thing about creatures. Was the will.
Right, I mean, that's what...
So if the will is killed or paralyzed, then the creature's essentially, its existence is...
Yeah, so in, I don't know if he does it in the 80s. Yeah, I think he's mentioned it because we quoted it somewhere. It's the will to will nothing keeps the will going.
Mm.
So that's, like I was saying, the theatrical performance you were describing in front of the tobacco headquarters. they
well,
were
the will to will
out.
Nothing, he was saying. The will nothing, he was using in conjunction with the idea of this that active nihilism where you kill yourself, I think.
No, wait, do that again. You talking about Croker?
Yeah.
He says the final will is to will nothing, because then you've still got a will to will.
Oh.
Now, what are you saying about nihilism, or what did you say?
No, I think in the last time we were, when we talked about passive and active nihilism.
Yeah.
Active nihilism, which was suicidal, was the will to will nothing, is the will to just will yourself away.
Yeah, suicidal nihilists. And passive nihilists, well, that's interesting. Could you say passive nihilism is another form of willing nothing?
The passive nihilist is the guy who goes out and shoots other people. It doesn't sound like passive to me, but he's willing to will the destruction around him. And then one, I forget was which one's the active.
No, we have it right here. Passive nihilists, driven by despair over their own botched and bungled instincts towards predatory styles of behavior. That implies...
Yeah, that's right out of... That, once again, is right out of Nietzsche. Because Nietzsche said that what happened to us when we were being translated from the animal world where our instincts were spontaneous and natural, then we move into culture, and all of a sudden, what do we do with all these instincts that want to be natural and spontaneous within the artifice of culture, which causes us to have to behave ourselves? And that's where the will itself becomes frustrated.
Okay, but remember he said the postmodern mood can alternate so quickly between hermeticism and schizophrenia. Hermeticism being like radical isolation.
Uh-huh.
And schizophrenia between the celebration of artifice and nostalgic appeals for the recovery of nature. So if Nietzsche was trying to recover nature, Croker's dealing with a situation 100 years later where you... are not trying to retrieve nature, you're oscillating between that and celebration of artifice.
Right.
And then he says, because the self is now like what the quantum physicists call a world strip, across which run indifferent rivulets of experience. Didn't even matter what you were experiencing. Another form of nothingness. So he says predatory nihilists, we read that, which sounds like people running out and killing people.
Mm-hmm.
And then to suicidal nihilists, who would always prefer to will nothingness rather than not will at all.
Yeah, that would be the act of suicide, willing yourself to die because you don't even want to, because there's no will in, you know.
But if you start shooting people, you're going to get suicided. You're going to get caught and killed.
Right, that's the predatory guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they're both nihilists. They're both doing nothing.
Yeah.
So in talking about his own pessimism as an intellectual strategy, he says, and second, pessimism is a deliberate intellectual strategy for breaking beyond the cyberspace of telemetric bodies and culture. Now, what's interesting is that is what digital interactive media provide in the 90s. They allow you to break away from the cyberspace of cloned ESP, or Croker is saying the voluntary ESP is the phase of telemetric bodies and culture, and breaking beyond that is Menippean satire.
That's yeah, now the word, I had to look... I had an assumption about what he meant by... Oh, did you say telemetric? Yeah.
Telemetried.
I had an assumption of what he meant by that, but I typed in telemetric, the word telemeter came up, and it says an apparatus for recording the readings of an instrument and transmitting them by radio. So he's saying that, you know, we're being examined and then rebroadcast.
Surveilled
and then rebroadcast.
Yeah.
And
so
then
more like the cloned ESP phase.
Yeah.
Then he says, we, meaning Croker's gang, seek to create a theoretical maneuver in which hypermodernism implodes into the detritus of its own panic scenes. Why? It is our conviction that the catastrophe has already happened. It's the end of the world.
Yeah, so that's a tricky statement. The simulacrum is imploding into the detritus of its own panic scenes, is that what it says?
Yeah, it's hypermodernism, but you could call that the simulacrum.
Yeah.
In which hypermodernism, simulacrum, implodes into the detritus of its own
panic. Where do we see evidence of the simulacrum's implosion into the detritus of its own panic scenes? I mean, I'm trying to figure out, is that represented in media somehow? Or?
Yeah, you'd have to read Baudrillard. There's a lot of inventory in his books about... examples of the simulacrum imploding in itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so he goes through all kinds of news events. I remember that book, Screened Out. That's a really good book because it has all these newspaper articles he wrote, and they cover topical events that many of them that have passed through the late 80s, early 90s, I think it is.
But I know the idea that it evokes in my mind when I think of this simulacrum imploding on itself is, in the old days when you turned off the TV, the image would compress into the center, and all that would be left would be a little white dot for a little, you know, for a few moments until that faded out.
Yeah, but he's saying that the image of burnout is a supernova,
mm-hmm.
a huge explosion of color and abundance of synesthesia.
Yeah, but that's not an implosion, so that's a different statement.
No, that's how the implosion comes across as that.
Oh.
It's the, like stars, when they collapse on themselves, they get brighter and brighter.
Oh, right, during the implosion.
Yeah.
Just before the explosion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You could look at the whole abundance of software, media, wealth, all kinds of wealth over the last 30 years in America as the burnout,
mm-hmm.
as this supernova shining while imploding.
Right.
And the Bush era represents the implosion.
Yeah.
Though you can't make that single plane because there's lots of wealth still being created. I mean, look at YouTube.
Yeah, does that implosion reverse itself and become an explosion like in a supernova?
Or a big war.
Yeah.
But the, what was I going to say here? The catastrophe has already happened, so we're seeing replays of the catastrophe, and that's what he means by the postmodern self enjoying the ecstasy of catastrophe.
Mm-hmm.
He keeps, and the terror of the simulacrum disappearing. It's like catastrophes for the chemical body and catastrophes for the TV body. Those are constantly replayed, and that's what the postmodern self enjoys, or is at least fascinated by.
Where do we see those replays happening in the TV and body?
Well, he says the ecstasy of catastrophe. So you're enjoying catastrophe, and you're doing it many times, and he's saying...
But how do we see that as a cycle in the TV body or the chip body?
How do we see it?
Yeah.
Well, the catastrophe's already happened.
Yeah.
So it's the end of the world already.
He says it's being replayed, like, over and over.
Yeah, I'm implying that he means it's replayed over and over.
Well, how do we see the replay of that when we look at the TV
body? Well, if someone showed you an inventory of all the news events of the 80s and then all the news events of the 90s, you'd see masses of people starving. You'd see buildings collapsing. You'd see plane crashes. You'd see wars. You'd see AIDS ravages. Just think of all the bad news that people have consumed over the last 30 years.
Right.
They're all images in your mind that should be programmed in you of disasters in all kinds of places, terrorist incidents. It just got bigger and bigger from the 80s and the 90s. You know, that's what CNN wrote on. Just think of kids shooting other kids in high school.
Yeah. Well, when I was a kid, the Red Scare was the big deal.
Yeah,
and
one
a lot of people,
one catastrophe.
Right. A lot of people lost sleep over the fear that, you know, we were going to get nuked and it was going to be the end of the world.
Yeah.
Now, we've seen so many times when we're about to get nuked, it's happened so many times to us that we're sort of becoming indifferent to the whole idea that it could happen.
There's your hyper-pessimism, and there's your across which run indifferent rivulets of experience. It's an interesting phrase, across which run indifferent rivulets of experience. It's like the Android meme is the thing that's experiencing, and it's indifferent to what it's experiencing, and we're indifferent to it.
Yeah. But I don't know if that's... See, when I was a kid and I was paranoid because I remember when I was like 5 years old and they were like, you know, having duck and cover exercises in the classroom, you know, like getting under your chair was going to save you from an atomic blast. But,
it shows you it was an invisible environment, as McLuhan would say. No one knew, could feel or see. They could feel it, maybe, but they couldn't see this creeping blob of potential nuclear damages happening to you.
Yeah.
And they didn't know that it was way more devastating. They couldn't absorb it than... the absurd notion of hiding under your desk.
Yeah.
But people actually did that.
Yeah.
Their perceptions were so limited.
Yeah. But I wonder if kids...
McLuhan said that, you know, the bomb was another example of the TV environment, decentralized information bombarding people from all over the place. So since people couldn't perceive the actual physical dimensions of the TV environment, they couldn't perceive the decentralized, strange effect of computers as an environment.
Right.
They couldn't see it. They still were going around reading the newspapers or looking at books. And very narrow sensory parameters based on the visual space.
Yeah.
They didn't even know they were discarnate.
Yeah.
So what were you going to say?
One thing I was going to say, what you just evoked in my mind was the idea that the, with respect to the atomic bomb, the imagery of it proliferated because of the TV was proliferating. And so everybody was sort of watching it, you know.
Think of how, you know, according to McLuhan, every new medium numbs the senses it extends. So if the TV is numbing the central nervous system.
You think how fast the sign proliferates, like an atomic blast.
Right.
In the old days, somebody writes a new book that has a new meme or a new sign. How long does it take to proliferate through book culture? But now in TV culture, the sign immediately proliferates everywhere simultaneously.
Right. Now, here's the thing I'm saying is that the image of the bomb and the end of the world, of a nuclear blast, nuclear war, was a simultaneous complementary image showing the effect of television, because television numbed the central nervous system. So that means everybody's central nervous system was in a zombie state.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a death. And so the collective consciousness imagined it was a physical death,
mm-hmm.
a nuking of their bodies by the atomic or hydrogen bombs.
Yeah.
So it was a rearview mirror image of an external explosion when actually you've been nuked inside by television.
Yeah.
And so that's why people start taking drugs to catalyze, to reinvigorate their central nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
It's like massaging something that collectively, instinctively, was seen as numbed.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the TV did that because it had a psychedelicizing effect in the nervous system. It brought in pure color pixels, you know, stimulating your brain, electric pixels.
Right. Now, that would be one aspect of it, but the collective numbing of everything by television. It numbs all, it's the new environment, it changes your senses, and there makes all the previous environments kind of obsolete.
Yeah, the new environment, the wheel amputates the leg, well, the TV amputates your central nervous system.
Right, so
so then where does the compensation happen? Because if the wheel amputates...
You know what the compensation is? It's the great culture of the 60s, what McLuhan called hyper-volume of sports, music, electrified music, movies, everything went into hyper.
Yeah.
It was like re-stimulating all the external senses.
Yeah.
But it was done by electronic media. But I want to say this. He has a section in the Take Today book, which came out in 72, about the sacred mushroom. He quotes a book on the sacred mushroom, and he was saying you had the atomic bomb mushroom cloud.
Right.
At the same time, it got people interested in psychedelic mushrooms.
Yeah, I wonder if that's when Gordon Wasson was doing his work on the psychedelic
mushroom. Yeah, he did it in the 56, 57, in middle 50s.
He
went down to South America.
Right. And if he'd reported on it 100 years earlier, nobody would have picked up on it, but everybody was like, picked up on it.
Yeah, and, well, everybody was needing it.
Yeah.
As a complementary stimulant to the anesthetizing effects of television.
Yeah.
And even though television itself was a powerful, had a lot of services, we're sort of talking about the disservices, or at least how the old chemical body would see it as a disservice.
Right. So, I don't know if this metaphor from nature works, but sometimes a farmer, he has a fruit tree, he'll when he wants it to fruit, when it's that time of year, he'll prune it back. Because the tree thinks it's dying, it starts going into overproduction, it starts producing new fruit real fast.
Right.
I wonder if killing the central nervous system, or the central nervous perceived it's being killed or threatened, then it goes into hyperproduction.
Yeah, I would say that was the booming economy of the 50s and 60s, and why women, in their little simple roles in the suburban housewife.
I can think of another reason for the
Let me just finish. So the suburban housewife felt limited doing one role. So they went into the economy, and somebody came up with a concept of women's lib to justify them going into the economy, because they actually, what McLuhan said, wanted hypermobility. So they wanted to have access to other environments and to be able to move through them rather than stuck in one place. And actually, maybe they're running from the TV in the living room in the suburban 50s home, early 60s on, because it's making them discarnate, and they turn into a hyperactivation of the chemical body.
Yeah. But the fact is, we went into hyperoperation in the 40s because the war effort was such that we were pumping out airplanes and war machines at an unprecedented rate, and everybody was drafted into the service of
right, but that was for ostensible war reasons. Then it subsided after World War II, and women went back into the specialist role of a housewife.
Oh, yeah.
Or the limited role, or perceived limited. So by the 60s, they demanded to be let loose again. But this time, they went to war in all the media environments, not just in factories.
Yeah.
They went into software, magazine, fashion, media.
Well,
think of Dreamgirls, the Supremes.
Yeah.
Seen that movie?
Yeah, not yet. Do you recommend it?
No, I haven't seen it, but I'm just saying that.
Well, 5,000 years of patriarchal suppression, all of a sudden they had an opportunity to have a voice. You'd think they'd come out, they would explode.
They had an opportunity to become predators and parasites.
Yeah.
Call it a voice. And, you know, it's well known that the women's lib movement was in for surprises by the 80s. They didn't get what they want. Matter of fact, there's a new book by a feminist, from an old school feminist, who says we got to stop the young women accepting a non-career life. They've gone back to it, gone back to sort of celebrating being a housewife and that.
Yeah.
And so she says, now it's better to be a career woman, or at least keep that option powerful in the schools or wherever young girls are programmed, because it's been given a bad rap.
Yeah.
And that is a reaction to an effect of, you could say that, in the 80s you started, women started, who had careers, got burnt out.
Yeah, try to do that and raise two kids, sure.
Right. So they realized, well, what the heck, they probably realized exactly around the time Croker's writing about the empty sign of any activity that one was doing in their work life.
Mm-hmm.
It was all being canceled anyways.
Yeah.
So retreat into a more relaxed lifestyle.
Yeah.
And but then the digital
Can still assert themselves in the home with in relationship to the husband. They're no longer the subservient woman that has to walk 5 feet behind the man, you know. So they even had a new role in the house.
Okay, yeah, look at it that way, is that they put on they went back and turned the chemical body into an art form. She was no longer in the previous environment of patriarchal control of the chemical body, when the chemical body was the hidden ground.
Yeah.
But then you go through the addition of the TV landscape, and eventual TV body starts to form in the 80s. Then the chemical body becomes an art form. So women say, well, I'm going to specialize in the chemical body, and I'm fully conscious of the world it went through, but I won't replay it that way.
Yeah.
I'll replay it as an autonomous, equal to all other chemical bodies, male, female, or bi, you know?
Yeah.
Or transgender.
Right.
But they were still in the environment of this woman in the bathtub, where the postmodern self as a catastrophe site. Now, that would be the chemical body. We can almost see that Croker is talking about the postmodern self as a chemical body.
But neither male or female.
Right. As a catastrophe site, and of the meaning of paradox is the deepest language of postmodernism. In this artistic production, the painting, an aesthetics of seduction counterpoints the presence of inner decay. And the promise of human companionship as reciprocity is immediately canceled by the reality of communication as radical isolation.
Yeah.
Now, you know,
actually, it is the image of a woman in the bathtub, though. I would think that this postmodern self is not, it does not have a sex. It includes human beings, period, or a chemical body. Chemical body doesn't make reference. When you use the word chemical body, it doesn't make reference to male and female. But this painting still is the woman in the bathtub.
Yeah, well, the painting was done a long 30 years ago, I imagine.
Yeah.
It's by
he selected it to reference it, and so
well, because of the way the gazes are and the canceled identities.
Yeah.
It's called Women Bathtub, but it has two characters in it.
Mm.
Now, you can see that through the 90s, the chemical body, you're right, it's not being genderized, and people played with it.
Yeah.
So the, what was I going to say, but so in the 80s, people miming signs of the communication, women who put on the housewife role model were aware of their role in the global theater and were militant about it. They didn't put up with any flack from the feminist idealists or or ideology. So and then the feminists reacted to that. So you have these people presenting their lifestyles with a whole manifesto aligned around it, super conscious of it, and writing tracks in different niche markets and demographics, targeting the housewife audience or the non-housewife, well, not audience, the housewife put on, or the non-housewife feminist put on, or the mixed media personality like Madonna.
Mm-hmm.
All this is going on in the dying global theater.
Mm-hmm. And but you know, with respect to the indifferent rivulets of experience, now maybe I've gotten to that space because I've been there, done that so many times. I'm getting tired of worrying about whether or not I'm going to get blown up tomorrow anyway. But kids today probably still suffer the same anxiety that I had when we were thought we were going to be nuked by the Russians, because they have, you know, they're young, they have this life that they're trying, all this potential lifetime to express, and they're constantly being hit with these ideas that, you know, well, you might not be around tomorrow.
That's right. So that they, the chemical body takes a while to grow up. Now, they do grow up faster, but the kids still go through the archetypal patterns of perception and instinct that the chemical body always went through in forming its identity. But they quickly bring in the TV body and the chip body. So they're juggling all four, but yeah, there's a sort of a lag where all the old issues, that's what I mean by my chart, is that the decade dance, the kids growing up go through these phases of the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s rapidly, but still through phases.
Mm-hmm.
So you're talking about the 50s phase there, the kids will still experience it, yeah?
Yeah.
And then we're now in a very strange situation, the juggling of these bodies and people are being able to create their own media spaces.
Mm-hmm.
Through YouTube or MySpace. It's totally almost unmeasurable what a kid is doing.
Yeah. You know, during the commune phase, was that the 80s or 90s? It was probably the 80s.
That was the 60s.
Well, you know, people were getting together to try to form, you know, cult, you know, 100 people, 50, 25, 30 people try to get together to form their own little cultural niche.
Yeah.
Now, it sounds like what you're saying, with everybody able to create... One person can create their own cultural niche. They don't even need a partner.
Right, and in the transition, and in the transition of the 90s, you had communalism in an urban setting, because people realized they couldn't escape to nature anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so the show Friends was a expression of this communalism in the chip-bodied lifestyle of the 90s.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was urban communalism.
Yeah.
And then you have the radical isolation caused by the YouTube, but the proactive, suicidal nihilist expression.
Mm-hmm.
You make your video and dump it out there and then go on and do something else. Make another video or...
Well, if you're successful, the ones that I see that are successful is where somebody hits a nerve with their little YouTube personal expression. And it retrieves a response from somebody else who creates a YouTube response. And then the thing takes off, and then people start dogpiling their little YouTube responses to each other's...
Yeah, it's a viral meme.
Yeah. So then they create this sense of community among people who may never actually meet each other in the flesh, but they sort of get acquainted through, you know...
Yeah, you could say their digital body.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You could say it's their TV body, maybe, but it's a Quark TV body. It's something you look at, you videotape, and then or you tape, and then you broadcast a little video TV show, and then someone makes another little mini TV show.
Yeah.
Whereas the digital body is the thing that is, it's being able to do that. It's turning instant TV broadcast sound bites of the TV body era into the content of the digital experience, of the chip body experience.
Mm-hmm.
So what would be chip body communication?
Well, maybe it's the gaming that's going on.
Yeah, yeah, the gaming could be, that's ongoing chip body stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're, man, we got about 10 minutes left probably.
I just saw this movie called 300.
Yeah, I heard it was incredibly violent imagery.
Yeah, but you don't feel raped or raked over the coal. It has this kind of, you feel this sense of, you know,
indifferent rivulets of experience?
No, you identify with the team, and it's like, you know, you have this pride, and you know, in like Nietzsche saying, expressing the will, even if it means expressing it unto putting yourself in the path of destruction. You know, what you are fundamentally is your will to live, then you're going to express that however you need to, uncompromisingly. And that's kind of how the film, but also the film seems like an extension of a lot of these online gaming things where people have to confront monsters and obstacles and amulets and magical powers and political threats and stuff like that. It seems like that they're learning from the chip body gaming world how to refine imagery in the movie theater.
Right. Okay,
now do you see that the movies are still the American archetype now that we're in the global chip?
Oh yeah, because it's more and more movies are made for young people.
Uh-huh.
You know, you see a lot of those movies are for 20-year-olds.
So even though the movie is puny compared to the TV chip body, I mean, we don't have a movie body, we have a TV and a chip.
Right.
You still say it's the archetype of the American meme.
Yeah, because Americans, the chemical body of Americans goes out to be alone, and people still, young chemical bodies, need to go out and date.
Yeah.
So the movie is the props for that experience.
Mm-hmm.
Now, movies are mostly seen on video now, right? People are downloaded off the net and all this stuff, DVDs, but the actual going out to be alone, which is the American chemical body archetype, that still goes on.
Yeah, the movie theater hasn't disappeared, and in fact, it seems to be doing as well as it ever has.
Yeah, because there's always people going through that phase. Like, all media stay. They're like nature. They don't disappear that quickly.
Well, nowadays, most people are probably like me. Nowadays, a movie comes out, and the first thing I say to myself is, I'll wait for that to come out on DVD, or, no, I want the full big screen experience on this one, you know.
Yeah. Okay, I want to end this with going to the next quote, because I probably positioned it appropriately. And what it is, it's from Coker's book, Before the Postmodern Scene. It's his first book called Technology in the Canadian Mind, subtitled Innes, McLuhan, and Grant. And that refers to Harold Innes, Marsh McLuhan, and George Grant, three Canadian thinkers, three different approaches to technology. But it's the Coker lays out the thesis that there's something particular about the Canadian experience that makes it notice communication technologies.
Right.
So this is a quote from that book, Technology in the Canadian Mind,
right,
subtitled Innes/McLuhan/Grant. Came out in 1984, self-published by Coker as an academic book, and this is what he says about McLuhan, and this is from page 85 and 86 of that book.
This is Coker's critique of McLuhan, which I have the feeling we're going to undermine his critique of McLuhan and say he didn't really fully understand McLuhan.
Yeah, but it is relevant. It is a later world. He's talking about McLuhan as not relevant to the seamless web.
Yeah.
And the abuse value of the sadomasochism of the seamless web.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's read it.
To dismiss McLuhan as a technological determinist is to miss entirely the point of his intellectual contribution. McLuhan's value as a theorist of culture and technology began just when he went over the hill to the side of the alien and serialistic world of mass communications.
Colon,
the, quote, real world, unquote, of technology where the nervous system is exteriorized and everyone is videoated daily like sitting screens for television. Just because McLuhan sought to see, that's italicized, see, the real world of technology, and even to celebrate technological reason as freedom, he could provide such superb first-hand accounts of the new society of electronic technologies. McLuhan was fated to be trapped in the deterministic world of technology, indeed to become one of the intellectual servo mechanisms of the machine world. Because his Catholicism failed to provide him with an adequate cultural theory by which to escape the hegemony of abstract media systems that he had sought to explore. Paradoxically, however, it was just when McLuhan became most cynical and most deterministic, when he became fully aware of the nightmarish quality of the, quote, medium as message, unquote.
No, medium as massage.
Massage, you know, that his thought becomes the most important.
Most important
as an entirely creative account of the great paradigm shift now going on in the 20th century experience. McLuhan was then, in the end, trapped as the, quote, figure, unquote, of his own making.
Trapped in the figure, in quotes, of his own making.
Yeah. His discourse could provide a brilliant understanding of the inner functioning of the technological media, but no illumination concerning how, quote, creative freedom, unquote, might be won through in the, quote, age of anxiety and dread, unquote. In a fully tragic sense, McLuhan's final legacy was he was the player, perpetrator.
He was the playful perpetrator.
Playful perpetrator and then victim of a sign crime.
Right, now you notice this comes back to what we were talking about a long time ago tonight concerning how creative freedom, there's your issue of imagination. Coker's saying there was no illumination concerning how imagination freedom, imaginative freedom, might be won through in the age of anxiety and dread.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've talked about how Coker, you know, underestimates McLuhan. We've talked about that earlier, right?
Yeah.
A long time ago. Let's not do that. Let's look at how much Coker is right here.
Yeah. One thing I want to insert here, when he says McLuhan, well,